morning of 1 Corinthians, I think it's well for us to keep in mind that chapters 8, 9, and 10 all deal basically with the same theme, and that has to do with the exercise of personal liberties, and especially with regard to the effect of our conduct in such matters upon others in either the encouragement or put the other way around. And what Paul was trying to help us to avoid is the discouragement of other brethren or perhaps causing them to stumble. So as we get into the 10th chapter, let's notice that as we have indicated, as we have observed, Paul takes several little side trips. I think you could rightly call them subtopics, but they're all related to this matter of the exercise of personal liberties, things in which God really is indifferent. As Paul put it in 1 Corinthians 8 and verse 8, that that God is not concerned about foods, and neither if a man eats is he the better, nor if he eats not is he the worse. Simply doesn't matter to God. But what does matter is our concern, the way we treat others with respect to these things, and whether we are of encouragement to them or rather may cause a stumbling. So what Paul's going to give us here is a general admonition, and it's one of his subtopics. He's going to take us back a little bit, a reminder of what he calls the days of our fathers. Now, what was Paul prior to his becoming a Christian? Now, he was a Jew, and when he speaks of our fathers, it would seem that he has in mind here his ancestors as fathers of the Israelite nation. And what he has to say here is going to bear upon the Corinthians, particularly, I think, Jews who would have come out of the synagogue in Corinth in obedience to Christ. But there are principles here that would involve or apply to Gentiles as well. So in verse 1 through 4, this will take us down through verse 13 before we get through with it, he talks about the fact that our fathers were baptized, he said, into Moses. And this is clearly a reference to their being liberated from Egyptian bondage, baptized into Moses. Paul says that under the cloud, in the sea, and this is a figurative sense, but they nonetheless were completely enveloped by the Red Sea to either side of them and the cloud that led them, and Paul refers to this as their being baptized into Moses. And Paul says of these people that they ate the same spiritual food. What's the reference here? It's easy to say, well, this was manna that God supplied to these people in their wilderness wandering, and that certainly involved that manna. But you recall, and I'm going to kind of move through these a little bit quickly. I know that in preparation for the class you've read this chapter, and I hope have taken into consideration the cross-references. But you recall in John the 6th chapter, when Jesus was challenged to show a sign, even as had Moses to the people of Israel in the wilderness, they said, you know, God gave us manna. And Jesus points out that it was not Moses that gave you this manna, but rather my Father who is in heaven. And what did that manna represent? I just bring that as a type over into the New Testament. Who is the bread of life? Well, Jesus is. And so in the background of what God was doing with Israel in the Old Testament is his, is the Word that would come forth in the New Testament as the Son of God, the Christ. And so he is involved in this as well. And they drank the same spiritual drink. They drank of that spiritual rock that followed them. I think we're all aware of the fact that in Exodus, the 17th chapter, very shortly after deliverance from Egypt, that the people were thirsty, and God supplied water from a rock for them. At Rephidim, later, very similar situation, but much later in the in their travels, at Kadesh Barnea, again, water is supplied for the people of Israel from the rock, and there's some differences here in detail that are not pertinent to this particular lesson, but the point is God supplied water for the people. Now, when Paul makes the point that they all drink of the same rock, is he talking about, all right, when God supplied water from this rock, they picked up this rock and carried it with them, and every time they needed water, why, they simply tapped into this rock? Now, that's, of course, ludicrous. That's not at all the idea. But rather, he said that that rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. Again, a type of the true water that God would send through his son Jesus. And make reference here to Jesus with his conversation with the Samaritan woman at the well, asking her for a drink, and that surprised her that here Jesus, a Jew, would talk to a Samaritan woman, and that he would ask drink of her. And Jesus made the statement to her that if you knew who I was, that you would ask water from me. And, of course, the water he had in mind, and as he described it, was water that would provide the quenching of thirst eternally. And she asked for that water. But here is, in the Old Testament, here is this figure of the Christ in the water that was supplied to Israel. And what we're seeing as well in this is that in all that God did in the Old Testament, and all that he did in dealing with Israel and bringing her out of bondage and creating in her or for her types, they were types of the Christ. And so the Christ is very much involved in Israelite history. In the beginning was the Word was with God. This Word was not only with God, but was God. The same was in the beginning, with God. Clear back to the very beginning of time. Jesus didn't suddenly become an entity when he was born into this world. He had always been, was with God, was himself God, and involved in all that God did. What Paul was trying to do here is drive home the point that this Christ that these Jews have obeyed is integral to God's plan, inseparable from it, and was with their fathers, as he now is with them in the new covenant. But Paul, and now he gets down to what he wants to deal with, and this is an admonition or a warning, but with most of them, God was not well pleased. Now, we're familiar with Old Testament history, and particularly Israel as they came out of Egyptian bondage, and so often would forget what God had done for them and went back to serving idols or murmuring, complaining. And so with most of them, God was not well pleased. And Paul points out the fact these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Now, what he is going to get at is that this matter of eating meats and dealing with one another is a matter not to be taken lightly, but that one's attitude in it can lead him to lust after or have desire for that which actually is contrary to God's will. And so there is to be caution here. Paul's going to, again, remind them of some of their history. At Exodus 32, verse 1 through 6, at Mount Sinai, shortly after the giving of the law, you remember that Moses is up on the mount receiving the Ten Commandments, and when he comes back, the people have given up on him. They think he's gone, and so they pressure Aaron into making for them an image. Aaron does that, a calf like that which the Egyptians had worshipped, and the people worship this calf, and the text says that they sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Now, the idea here is not a picnic, but it is a feast that is dedicated to this pagan god, And the playing that is involved here is not anything to do with horseshoes or badminton or anything else, but rather the licentious practices that were integral to pagan worship. People had now involved themselves in that, and Paul's reminding them that God had delivered them, blessed them, and yet they turned right around and became involved in this. And then in Numbers 25 and verse 1 through 9, where Balaam, at the behest of King Balak, had tried to curse the people of Israel, and Balaam is characterized as a prophet. He could not curse the people of Israel. He simply could not get it done. Rather, he would bless them. But there was a way that Balaam could bring the people of Israel to curse themselves. And so he is identified as the one who involved them in the worship of Baal, very common Moabite practice, in which their worship was expressed by and involved licentious, lascivious, fornicating practices, and the people of Israel are involved in that now, and so God would bring his wrath upon them because of that. One of these, at the Jordan River, when God tells Israel to go in and take the land, and 10 spies, there's 12 were sent, 10 come back and saying, we can't do it, we can't take the land, the people are too great for us. And there were two, Caleb and Joshua, that said, yes, we can. They are our bread. Now, today we say we're going to eat their lunch. What Caleb was saying is that they are in our hand. God will deliver them to us. And the people were ready to stone Caleb and Joshua. Now, that was at the Jordan. And it was then that God was ready to destroy Israel, was dissuaded from that by Moses, playing the part of a mediator. But nonetheless, none of those who had rebelled against God would ever enjoy the land, the promised land of Canaan. And then I make reference here also to what took place at Mount Hor, and that takes us back to the situation with Balaam and his bringing destruction upon Israel, or causing her to bring it upon herself. And then at Numbers 21, verse 4 through 9, is an express reference to the people murmuring against God. You know, God brought us out of Egypt here to die in the wilderness, and they're complaining and carrying on. And it was on that occasion that God sent the serpents among them that struck so many of them, and told when the plea was made in their behalf, God told Moses to raise up, you recall, the brazen or the brass serpent. And those who looked upon it would, by that expression of faith, be protected or healed. But thousands of the people fell on that occasion because of their rebellion against God. Now, what Paul is doing is reminding these people of the fact that though they had been delivered by God and blessed by him, that the people turned against God in their mind and therefore in what they did. So these examples, Paul said, were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Everything God had been planning throughout all of the ages is now brought to fruition in the new covenant of Jesus Christ, but we have these things back in the Old Testament for examples that God is not a patsy. No one takes him for granted. God is not to be treated casually. Yes, he bestows his blessings, and when he does, as any suzerain king, he expects our devotion and our service to him, and rebellion against him will not go unnoticed. So we need to be aware of those examples back in the Old Testament. So therefore, Paul said, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Does that apply to us? Sure it does. The statement of Proverbs 16, verse 18, that pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall, And Paul's trying to drive the point home with these Jewish Christians in Corinth, but applicable as well to Gentile Christians, that we need to pay attention to what we're doing, because even as these people in ancient Israel, who had been blessed so richly by God, sinned against him and therefore fell, so also can we take heed lest we fall. And so in verse 13, Paul points out there's a source of strength, God who provides escape from temptation, a passage I think that we're all familiar with, have heard many, many times, and rightly so, that when Israel in the wilderness was discouraged, when she began to murmur against God, what should she have been doing rather than murmuring against Moses and therefore against God? What did this verse teach? Saber?
Gratitude.
Attitude, you're saying?
Gratitude.
Oh, gratitude. Gratitude toward
God.
Expressed
in
prayer. Sure. So that rather than murmuring against God, because things are difficult at times, and they are, they were then, they are now, they always will be, as long as Satan is working to try to distract us from God, we're always going to have difficulties. So who do we turn to for strength? Yeah, to God. And that's the point Paul's trying to drive home to these folks. Don't forget him. Verse 13, no temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. Oh, now wait a minute. What I am having to deal with, what has come upon me, nobody has ever had to bear a burden like this. It's not true. There's nothing that's ever happened to me, and it hasn't always been easy, nor has it been easy for you all of the time. But there's nothing that has happened to me or to you that is not common to everybody. So that's not an excuse by any means. But in all of this, what is God? Paul tells us very expressly, God is what? He's faithful. He's reliable. You can count on God to keep his promises and therefore to deliver one from his trials and from his temptations. God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. So when I am confronted with temptation, when a trial is heavy upon me and I give in to it, whose fault is that? It's mine. And so with you. And that's the point Paul's trying to drive home with these people. Look to God. Always trust God. All right. Now Paul's going to get back. Well, this raises a question, and I think we've pretty well covered it already. How does this relate to the matter of the exercise of personal liberties? For instance, the eating of meats and so forth. Well, as we're going to see, here is one who understands that he has a liberty to eat what he will. But exercising that with an attitude of arrogance and of unconcern for others, first of all, the arrogance itself can lead one into the fall. And secondly, if he causes a brother to stumble, that in and of itself is wrong. And so this is the point Paul is trying to drive home. Again, a subtopic, a little side trip, but it has to do with this matter of the exercise of personal liberties. So, be aware of the danger of idolatry. And that was, of course, what was prevalent in a city like Corinth, as we have discussed. How about idolatry? You kind of skate the edges of it and not to worry too much about it. After all, no faithful child of God is ever going to be involved in a thing like this. Right? Let him who thinks he stands do what? Take heed, lest he fall. And so what Paul is saying is, don't toy with it. Don't play with it. Don't come just as close as you can, or as you think you can, without becoming involved in it, but rather flee. Run for your life. Don't let the exercise of personal liberties involve you in idolatry, he is telling these folks, and that applies to us as well today. Different forms of idolatry. Paul's explanation, or Paul's statement of what idolatry is in Romans, the first chapter, the people, the ancient people and people today, turn from the Creator to worship the creature. When we let the creature, the things of this world, become greater to us than is the God who created, what is that? It's idolatry. There isn't any one of us who is not tempted in this regard. We need to always be careful. Paul said, I speak to wise men. With all of the problems in Corinth, is he telling them, basically, you folks are really smart, you've got all of the answers, you're wise? Is that his point? And if not, what is the source of their wisdom? Look at the verses that we've already studied. Chapter 1, verse 24, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. Verse 30, by God's will, Christ is made unto us wisdom. Not the philosophy of the Greeks or the power of the Romans or any of that sort of thing. And certainly not inherent in man, who is basically weak and as unknowledgeable as he thinks he is knowledgeable. Rather, God's wisdom is in Christ. And so Paul, at chapter 3 and verse 18, you recall, said, if any man thinks himself to be wise in this world, let him become what? A fool, that he may be wise. That is, become what the world thinks of as foolish, and therefore one who would lean upon God and trust in God's Christ is a fool. But what is he in the sight of God? What is that? It's wisdom. And so, Paul said, I speak as to wise men. Judge for yourselves what I say. Compare it with what I've been teaching you. So what is signified by eating the Lord's Supper? This is very interesting, and it is extremely important. It is as applicable to us in our time as it was to the Corinthians in theirs. At verse 16, 17, Paul said, the cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion? Now that's an interesting word. Koinonia, Greek. You've heard this explained 1,000 times. What does that word mean? What is another rendering of it?
Sharing. In the American standard, the word sharing.
Sharing? All right. Communion, sharing.
Fellowship.
Fellowship is, I think, practically defined as joint participation. What in this day and time is my participation in the blood that Jesus shed? The cup that I drink that represents what? This is my blood, Jesus said, so that I commune with Him. I share with Him. I have fellowship with Christ in the shedding of His blood through this cup. How about the bread? The bread which we break. Is it not what? Again, look at the text. Verse 16, the bread which we break, is it not the communion? Again, the sharing, the fellowship of the body of Christ. The body which He gave. This is not the body in the sense of the church. This is the body that Jesus gave to be crucified. And I share with Him in that sacrifice to the extent that I meditate upon that and think about it as I break this bread. I hope we're impressed with the fact that eating the Lord's Supper is not just a matter of pinching off a little unleavened bread and drinking a little container of the fruit of the vine, that it is rather a sharing with Jesus of his sacrifice, his blood and his body, and it is communion with him. It's true that we do this together, but my communion is not with you, nor you with me. I do not sit as I take of this Lord's Supper and think about the persons on either side of me and wonder how they're doing and all of this sort of thing. And that does not mean that I'm unconcerned about them. I am, but not in this context. In the context of the Lord's Supper, upon what, or more properly put, upon whom are my thoughts to be concentrated? Upon Jesus. His body and his blood. This supper is a communion with him. Now, Paul's going to give us another example, this one from the Old Testament. What was signified by the Levitical priest eating from the altar of God? As people gave their tithes, it would include animal sacrifices, and a tenth of that went to the priest from which they ate. So they literally ate of the altar. What was signified by that?
Fellowship.
That they were worshipers of Baal or Molech or what? That they are worshipers of the God to whom this altar was devoted. Same with the supper. When we eat the supper, we are saying that we are servants of and devoted to the Christ whom this supper represents. What am I saying then? This is a quote from Paul. That an idol is anything? How about it? He's made the point already, hasn't he? That no, the idol is nothing. Or what is offered to idols is anything? No. Just because a pagan takes what God has provided in terms of flesh and offers it to a non-existent God did not change the nature of what God had provided. It's nothing. That's not the point. Rather, Paul said, that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God, and I do not want you to have fellowship with demons. So, if when I eat the Lord's Supper, I am, in essence, demonstrating the fact that I am devoted to the Christ that this supper represents, if I go to the temple of an idol with the clear understanding that the service that goes on there is dedicated to that pagan god, or in our time, to some false religion of any kind, what is said by my doing that? And I'm trying to split my devotion. Part of it to the Lord of the Lord's Supper, and part of it to the gods of this world. Does that work? To the contrary, that's what Paul is trying to get these people to see. No, it does not work. It is not pleasing to God, and it does not express complete, unqualified devotion to God. So why, Paul? He said, because you cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. Verse 21, that you cannot partake of the Lord's table and of the table of demons. You cannot do both. God simply will not accept it. So, if I'm going to serve God, what do I need to do? What do you need to do? I need to make up my mind. Well, as Joshua put it, decide this day whom you will serve. Either the God that had delivered Israel from bondage and brought her into the land of Canaan, or the gods which your father served on the other side of the river. Make up your mind. because you cannot do both, and we can't either. Okay? Paul has kind of gotten down to brass tacks, hasn't he? But it certainly is a good lesson for all of us. Or do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than He? Takes us back to the Ten Commandments. You shall have no other God before me, God said to Israel. What is God? What quality or characteristic of Him that is there specified? I am a jealous God. That doesn't mean God is overtaken by the great green monster of envy and this sort of thing, but it means that He is jealous of, that He covets the devotion of His people. Do we understand that? Those of you who are married, do you covet? Are you jealous of the affection of your spouse? Or are you happy if your spouse shares the affection that he or she has for you with somebody else? Picture isn't hard to get, is it? So Paul is driving the point home that we need not to provoke the Lord to jealousy in the sense that He is displeased with the devotion that we express. Are we stronger than He? Of course, that's a rhetorical question. Of course not. We're not in a position where we can tell God, all right, I'll give you this much, but I'm going to give the rest of me to this or that. And so tell God how it's going to be. Express the terms upon which we will serve Him that suit us. Are we stronger than He? No. God states the terms of the covenant, and we must either accept them or reject them. But if we want the blessings of the covenant, we must accept the terms that God has laid down in that covenant. So back to the primary subject then. That's care for the spiritual well-being of one another. Remember, this chapter 8, chapter 9, chapter 10 are all devoted to that basic theme. So in verses 23 through 30, Paul will take this up. He said, all things are lawful for me. Now, any time we run across that expression, all things, let's be careful. Because it's easy to say, well, now, all things, well, that means everything, no matter what. All things is always modified by
context.
What he's talking about, context. Context is always king, and everything that is said within a particular context must be kept in that context. So when Paul said, all things are lawful for me, what is the context? What is he talking about? You know, basically, what I've been saying to you, all things are lawful for me, even worshiping an idol in a temple and partaking of lascivious services there. If Paul's saying that, what's he talking about? Meats? Personal liberties? Yeah, the eating of those meats is lawful for me, Paul is saying. But not all things are helpful. Are there circumstances under which the eating of meats or the exercise of some other personal liberty might not be helpful? That's the point Paul's been driving home, isn't it? All things are lawful for me, but not all things edify. We used the example earlier, and let's resort to it again. In our time, our culture, let's say we convert someone who is a religious vegetarian, not somebody who's vegetarian because they think that's a healthier way to live, although that I think might come under the same principles. But we convert someone who is a religious vegetarian. And remember, God could care less whether this person eats meat or not, whether he is carnivorous or herbivorous. God simply doesn't care. But how many of you folks enjoy meat? It's about everybody. So since all of us, at least most of us, if not all of us, enjoy meat, we
we convert this person, baptize them into Christ, but this person will not eat meat, and so we're going to get together and have a large feast of some kind, and it's going to feature all sorts of meats, and we are going to work on this person to get them to eat meat and belittle them if they cannot, and browbeat them into doing what violates their conscience?
No.
Is that helpful?
No.
No, it's not. Does that edify?
No.
No, it does not. So what is Paul saying here? Be careful in the exercise that you make of your personal liberties.
Don't try to force this person into something that violates their conscience when the thing itself is indifferent to God. So let no one seek his own, but each one the other's well-being. I invite this person to my house for a meal. Try to get better acquainted with them. If they are a vegetarian, guess what we would serve them? Vegetarian meal. Lots of good stuff that does not have meat, believe it or not. Yeah, respect this person. In time, they may learn, and they may be able, with good conscience, to eat meat. But it's not my lot to try to force this upon that person. Now, let's talk about the application of these principles. Paul said, eat whatever is sold in the meat market. Now, remember, the meats that were offered to these idol gods would be taken by the priests, let's say of Aphrodite here in Corinth, and part of it would be consumed by them. Part of it would be used in feasts that are dedicated to this pagan goddess, and part of it, a good part of it, would be sold in what the King James calls the shambles or the meat markets. The profits from that going to this particular priesthood of this pagan god. So here, I've been baptized into Christ and I'm going to go to the meat market and buy meat. How about this? Is there any meat here that was offered in sacrifice to Aphrodite? Probably. What difference does it make? It's because a pagan has offered a juicy filet mignon to Aphrodite. Does that change the nature of the meat or God's purpose in providing it? No. So go ahead and eat, Paul said, asking no question for conscience' sake. Why? Because the earth is the Lord's and its fullness. This meat, everything else that is provided by God for us, is of the Lord. And of the earth and all its fullness. And if any of those who do not believe invites you to dinner, I think the old King James puts that in, perhaps frames it in a little better light, invites you or bids you to a feast. The American Standard of 19:1 just simply says, if any of those who do not believe bid you or biddeth you in the language of that day, what then? Eat whatever is set before you. So I am invited by this person to his house for a feast, and this dish is set before me, and I'm going to grill him. Where did you get this meat? But was this ever offered by sacrifice to an idol? Who cares? It doesn't matter yet. Eat whatever is set before you, asking no conscience or no question for conscience' sake. But there's an exception to this. But if anyone says to you, now then, he sets the parameters. He's going to set the stage here for the eating of this meat as an expression of devotion to the god, the pagan god that it was devoted to. If anyone says to you, this was offered to idols, then what? Leave it alone. Do not eat it for the sake of the one who told you, that is, this pagan worshiper. You don't want to give him the idea that you go along and you're willing to compromise your devotion to God and share that devotion with a pagan god. And for conscience' sake, for the earth, same reason, for the earth is the Lord's and its fullness, so I'm not going to give this pagan the idea that the meat he is serving me is a blessing from this pagan god, for the earth is the Lord's, the God of heaven, and all its fullness. And full credit, full thanksgiving should be given only to him. So Paul says, conscience, not yours. I can eat this meat in all good conscience, unless this person imposes his idolatry on me. Not yours, but the others. That is, another person who stands by. I want to be sure that I do not cause this person, and particularly a brother or sister in Christ, to partake of this in worship to the idol, because they see me eating this under these circumstances and assume, well, I guess it must be okay after all. Not my conscience, but this other person's conscience must be taken into consideration. For why is my liberty judged by another man's conscience? He has scruples about it. And that should not dictate my conscience, but it does indicate or dictate the way I treat this person and the considerations that I give them as they're coping with this problem, that I will not cause them to stumble or lead them into doing that which he or she thinks is wrong. So not my conscience, but that of the other. But if I partake with thanks, why am I evil spoken of for the food over which I give thanks? In a different context, 1 Timothy 4, and verse 4 and 5, Paul is actually talking here about the time coming when out of religious thinking, imposition of false religious ideas, that there will be those who forbid to marry and command to abstain from meats. That would occur early on, and it has certainly been manifest in the Roman Catholicism of our day, that Paul said every creature of God is good and nothing is to be refused if it is received with thanksgiving, for it is sanctified or set apart by the word of God. And what else?
Prayer.
My receiving of it with thanksgiving to the God who provided it. Now, Paul's going to bring us to some conclusions here. So, therefore, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. It's not all about certain personal liberties that I have, and I'm going to exercise them whether anybody likes it or not, under any circumstance, regardless of whether it is helpful, regardless of whether it edifies or not. Doesn't work. Not the attitude that Jesus had. Not the attitude he wants me to have. So whether you eat or drink, what comes first? Doing what I do to the glory of God. Be sure it serves his purpose. Give no offense. Let's take a minute or two to talk about this one. This is not the first time that Paul has expounded on this. We'll just make this a separate chart. Give no offense, and here in the chapter we're studying, chapter 10, and down at verse 32, give no offense, not to Jews, not to Greeks, not to the church of God, that is, Christians. Now, where have we seen this before? Very same three categories in different terms. Don't head for the doors. We've got 5 minutes. Well, let's go back a little bit. Chapter 9. You talked about this last week. Chapter 9 and verse 20. And Paul's talking about consideration for others and not causing them to offend. And Paul's talking about his own personal life. At verse 20, to the Jews. I became as a Jew that I might win Jews. And then Paul says to those who are under, our English translations say, the law. And every commentary I have ever read will say that Paul's still talking about Jews, because he's talking about those who are under the law of Moses. There's a problem with that. The article "the" is not in the Greek text. Paul is simply saying those who are under law. Who? Jews are under the law of Moses. Who else is under law in Old Testament times? Everybody else. And they were not Jews, but what were they? They're Gentiles, or what would be called in first century Greeks. Same category of people. Now notice this one. Paul said, and those, this is verse 21, those who are without law. Now notice the parenthetical addition to this identification. These people who are without law are not being without law toward God, but what? Under law to Christ. Who in the world is that? That's the Christian. And so in chapter 10, give no offense, not to Jews, not to Greeks, not to the church of God. And Paul had expressed this back in chapter 9, Jews, those who are under law, that is Gentiles, and those who are without law, but not being without law toward God, but under law toward Christ. And I ask the question, how in the world can that be? Are we under a strict law system? So that if you keep the law, everything's great. If you break the law, you're dead duck. Because the law has no mercy. Is that the gospel? No, it isn't. Is there anything about the gospel that imposes commandments? It has the nature of law. Yes. But if we fall short of the law of Christ, what is there that makes the gospel different than any other system ever? Forgiveness, grace, mercy. Now back in Romans 6, in verse 14. When Paul talked about our being baptized into Christ and answering the question, shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? God forbid, he said. And then having discussed that, at verse 14 he said, sin shall not have dominion over you. Now listen to this. For you are not under law. And here the New King James rightly leaves out the word "the." You are not under law, but under what kind of a system is the gospel? Under grace. One of the most fundamental things that we need to learn, and that so many of our brethren need to learn, is the nature of the gospel. Is it a law system, plain, simple, and only? Or is it a system of merciful grace? Which? Well, if it does not have merciful grace, we might as all, well, just quit. Because without the mercy of God, without the grace of God, not one of us is ever going to go to heaven. So we're not under a system of law as such, but under grace. Does grace require the meeting of conditions that are stated in the form of commandments or law? Yes. But when we fall short of that, is there a remedy? The grace of God. One more passage. Sounds like my 5 minutes got passed in a hurry, but these passages, Galatians 5 and verse 18, where Paul is, again, dealing with this same matter. And he says, if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under, strike the word "the," it's not in the Greek text. If you are led by the Spirit, you are not under law. Back in chapter 3, he made the point that Christ has redeemed us from the curse of law. The curse of law is break it and die. We have been released from that by the grace of God. Doesn't mean we have nothing to obey, but it means that when we fall short of God's will, there is merciful forgiveness. All right, let's just notice, why be concerned then about pleasing others? Paul said, just as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of many. Paul, why would you do that, and why do you enjoin that on us? That they may be saved. My salvation and the salvation of those with whom I deal is more important than any other consideration. All right, thank you so much.